It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, new legislation aims to keep people away from a proposed mining site. We'll hear from WPR reporter Sean Johnson about today's hearing.
But first, colleges across the nation are kicking off the fall semester this week, and as students start cramming for exams in the coming months, some might be tempted to engage in less than honest behavior. And they're not alone. Surveys have shown that nearly three-quarters of college students cheat at least once during their undergraduate careers.
And while colleges might be eager to point the blame at lazy or morally challenged students, our next guest says the problem isn't with the individual. Rather, it's with university curriculums and courses, which are pretty much designed for cheating. And he says, based on current trends in college education, the problems may be about to get worse.
Joining us now is James Lang. He's a professor of English and director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College in Massachusetts. His new book is Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So that's the main point of your book, isn't it? That we shouldn't, the main point isn't why do these scurrilous students go out and cheat and what's wrong with them as individuals? It's what's going on in the academic situation. Why is that?
So what I'm interested in looking at is the way I like to phrase it is that cheating is an inappropriate response to a learning environment that's not working for the student. So both sides of that are important. The fact that it's an inappropriate response is important, and that's where a lot of the energy to talk about cheating has focused thus far, to look at the nature of the type of student that cheats or look at what's going on in the campus culture. But to me, the second half of that statement is equally important. The learning environment, for some reason, is not working for that particular student. They don't feel motivated to learn the material. They don't feel like they've been given all the tools they need or they have the tools they need. They don't feel like they're capable of succeeding on that assignment. And so my goal was to sort of look at that and see, are there certain features of a learning environment that tend to induce cheating in students? And if so, can we modify them? In some cases, maybe we can't, but in some cases, maybe we can.
I see headlines every now and then suggesting something along the lines of there's a new spike in cheating, or the internet's making there be more cheating, or a cheating epidemic. Is this anything really all that new, though?
No, it is absolutely not new. The first major survey on cheating in higher education was conducted in 1963 by a doctoral student at Columbia University, and he surveyed around 5,000 students at 100 different institutions. And it was at that point that he discovered that around 75% of college students admitted to cheating at least once in their college career. The most current data that we have, which stretches from 2002 to 2010 by a researcher named Don McCabe, actually has that number a little bit lower. And so the numbers clearly are not increasing. They're either stable or dropping slightly. But the story that you frequently hear and you see reported in the media is, you know, this is getting worse and technology's sort of taking this out of control. We really don't have good evidence to suggest that that's true.
Well, even if it's not spiraling upward, you are still concerned about it as a
problem. Oh, yeah, of course. 75% is a large number. And, you know, that's the number of students that cheat at least once. The number of students who cheat more than once is much smaller. It's hard to pin it down exactly, but I would guess between 10 and 20%. But still, if you're in a seminar of 20 students, you know, that means you could have 2, 3, 4 students who are regularly cheating, and that's much too much.
Well, you talk about how universities unintentionally, obviously, encourage cheating, and you lay out some of the different factors that make a cheating-rich environment. One of those factors is high stakes. Talk about that.
So one of the things, the studies that I looked at in my research was a comparative analysis of cheating in Japanese and American universities. And these researchers looked at psychology classes in Japan and psychology classes in the United States. And they were suspecting that they were going to find higher rates of cheating in the United States because they were just sort of, their hypothesis was that the Japanese culture was more education-oriented, was more community-oriented, and so they would see less cheating. What they actually found was the opposite. The rates of cheating in these Japanese courses were double the rates in the United States. So they went and looked and tried and see, well, what could possibly be the cause of this? And what they found was that in these Japanese classes, the students had just a final exam in the course, whereas in the American courses, there were multiple chances for the students to demonstrate their learning. There were quizzes, tests, papers, all that kind of stuff. And so the hypothesis that comes from that is that when you give students only one or two opportunities to earn their grade in the course, you're putting a lot of pressure on those opportunities. And the other problem is the students really don't know if they know the material. You know, if 3 months go by and now all this is my only chance to take a test, I really don't know if I know the material. So what I might do is prepare myself to cheat if it turns out that I get into the exam and I just look like I don't think I can do it.
Has there been research following up on that within the United States? Say, Professor Jones's class has one really high-stakes exam. Professor Smith's has a bunch of tests spread out through the year, and students cheat more on one than the other?
I haven't seen any follow-up like that just in the United States. But my interest in this particularly is not only about and the sort of heart of the book's argument is that the things that are in a classroom environment that induce cheating also reduce learning, even for the students that don't cheat. And we do know, based on cognitive theory and about how human beings learn, that more frequent assessment of students helps them learn because it gives them the opportunity to try whatever it is that you're testing them on, get feedback, try it again. And the more frequently we do that, the more they learn. So to me, it's less important that we have multiple demonstrations of this phenomenon. We have a couple good examples of how we have seen this operate in terms of cheating, and we know absolutely that more assessment, more opportunities for students to earn their grade definitely improves learning. So to me, that sort of gives us a clear indicator that this is the direction that we should be moving. We should be moving away from, you know, two midterms and a final and moving toward more opportunities for students to demonstrate their learning.
And that's a running theme through your book, the idea that this grading shouldn't be a hurdle that students are overcoming, but a way to encourage them to actually learn and remember the material in the long haul.
Yeah, and another example where we see this is in how we construct and give students choices in terms of how they demonstrate their learning to us. So frequently, you know, we design courses at the college level, and then we say, all right, you've got to do these five things, and that's how you're going to show your learning to me. Well, when we do that, we put a real strong emphasis on those five things, as opposed to learn this material as a whole, understand it, you know, see how it's going to be relevant to your life. If we were able to say, here's 20 different ways to demonstrate your learning to me, pick the five that make the most sense to you and that you find the most interesting, that, again, is going to take pressure off the individual assignments and give students more choice and control over how they show their learning and reduce their incentive and opportunity to cheat.
Sounds like a lot of work for an instructor, though.
It can be, and there's no question about that. And unfortunately, there is not an easy fix here where I can just say, you know, you can make these changes and your workload will stay exactly the same. that's just not the case. It's like teaching is, you know, it's hard work. And there are ways to do it, though, because not everything has to be accorded the same level of grading. We frequently talk about frequent low-stakes assessments. So a low-stakes assessment is something that, you know, might only be worth 1% of the final grade. And you don't have to give the real extensive feedback on something like that. You can ask the students to, you know, write a quick paragraph in response to a question. You just look it over, give it a check, check plus, check minus. That sort of thing can be really helpful, but it also doesn't add a ton to the instructor's workload.
Another fact you talk about is how students are motivated to learn, and you use the phrase extrinsic versus intrinsic learning motivation. Can you distinguish what those are and why one is better than the other?
Extrinsic motivation is when people are motivated to get the reward at the end of the experience. So in our case, that would be the grade, but an extrinsically motivated athlete might be concerned just about getting the medal or the you know, being in the record book, as opposed to really loving the game and really taking great pleasure in becoming the best at something. So for us, the extrinsic motivation typically is the grade that students get at the end of the semester. Intrinsic motivation means you are really actually interested in the thing. You love this material. You want to learn it. You see how it's going to be useful in some future way. An extrinsic motivated student just wants to get through the material to get to the prize at the end, basically. Now, we know that extrinsic motivation produces what sometimes is called shallow or strategic levels of learning, where students can figure out how to get through the material in such a way that's going to earn the grade they want. But as soon as they get out of that course, it goes right out of their heads. And so it produces very little long-term retention. Intrinsically motivated students, by contrast, tend to engage in more deep levels of learning. And likewise, a student who's interested in really learning the material has no incentive to cheat. Cheating wouldn't make sense for that student because they really want to learn the material. By contrast, an extrinsically motivated student has good incentive to cheat. If all they want to get is the reward at the end, if they can take a shortcut there, they'll take it.
What's the trend in academia, though? It seems like from grade school on up, there's a trend toward more testing and more high-stakes testing and more attention on measurement and grading.
Well, we have to distinguish between two things. Frequency of assessment, actually, I think, is a good thing if it's done in the right way, and it's not necessarily frequent high-stakes testing where, for example, in grade schools where students are being frequently given these, they're probably called something different in every state, but
assessment tests.
Yeah, these assessment tests. And if they're kind of constantly being drilled to just get to this one high performance thing, that's a bad thing. But if students are being given frequent opportunities just to demonstrate their learning and to try new things, I think that's really terrific. But we have to be careful about how we do that. We want to make sure that students see that these are learning opportunities and they're not just things that we're doing in order to measure them and punish them.
We're talking with James Lang about cheating in higher education, and we want to hear from you. Have you ever cheated in school, college, or otherwise? Why'd you do it? And what do you think should be done to get cheating in higher education under control? Give a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can email talk@WPR.org. We'll get to your calls after the break. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our discussion about cheating in college with James Lang. His book is Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty. Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go right to the phones. We've got Tammy on the line in Greenfield. Tammy, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Listening to the very... nice conversation to have, and it makes me remember the times I have cheated my way through school, especially high school. I was saying that one time when I did get busted, my teacher made me retake the test, and she told me it was going to be harder. So I took that extra time to study, and I actually did better on my retake. And even to this day, I still remember that topic. There's, I think in high school, I didn't have to pay, and I had to be there. It was just basically to get through. And now, I'm in college, I'm picking my classes. I realize I learn a lot more, and it stays with me better because I think being older now, I'm more interested in it or whatnot. It's just funny that, I wish I never did cheat my way through school, and I wish I never did that. I totally regret it. But it just makes me realize, just listening to this makes me realize how much... how more important it is now that I'm older and I'm taking classes that I actually really do focus and
gotcha.
I'm interested in material.
Well, thanks, Tammy, and a lesson learned there, I guess. James, what do you think? I mean, she gives an object lesson. She later on, or she now, is more interested in actually learning the material than getting the grade.
Yeah, I mean, her sort of description of her experiences fits completely with what the research would tell us, which is, first of all, students do cheat even more in high school than they do in college. So those rates are high, and I think a big part of that is because students have much more difficulty seeing the sort of relevance of their course material to their futures and their lives, and students also have much less choice in terms of what they're going to take in high school. And she's absolutely right. Once you get to college, you start to get a lot more choice, and you can start taking the classes that actually do interest you, and then that taps into that intrinsic motivation that I was talking about. We also do know that, for example, students cheat more in introductory classes in college than in upper-level classes, which, again, gets to the same notion here. Frequently, students are being required to take these larger introductory classes, which they are going to have less of an interest in. Once they get into their majors and they're taking the classes that they choose, they tend to cheat less.
Is there a way to teach those classes that everybody's got to take, whether in high school or college, that makes them, I know it's hard to do, but maybe with teenagers in particular, makes them want to learn it and not worry about the grade, but just worry about the actual learning?
If I had a good answer for that, I'd be a millionaire. But I do have a suggestion. My argument here is that typically we think about our courses, especially at the college level, as covering things. So we like to say, I'm teaching a British literature class, and I'm going to cover British literature from 1800 to the present. Well, I think a lot of times when we do that, the students are sitting out there saying, well, why should I care about British literature from 1800 to the present? And it's a good question. So my argument is that instead of envisioning classes which on that coverage model, we should think about designing courses around problems, questions, and challenges. And that, for example, we find a major problem that, you know, we know that people are generally interested in, or that we can make them interested in with a good story. And then the class becomes, here's this problem in my discipline or area, and over the course of the semester, you're going to get all the information you need to solve this problem. Or here's a big question about life that a lot of people have been asking. Let's talk about it the first week, and then over the course of the next 14 weeks, you're going to read a lot of stuff, and we're going to talk about it in such a way that will help you answer that question. And the key is you got to get them to care about that initial problem, question, or challenge. But I think that's easier than we may suspect. You know, we know there are certain things that 17, 18, 19-year-old kids tend to care about, and I think we have to try to tap into those things.
You know, I know a couple of professors at Beloit College here in Wisconsin who did a class like that. They organized it around the theme of settling Mars. One was a geologist, so they had science problems to solve, and one was a political scientist, and they were talking about how to organize the society. That sounds right up your alley there.
That is. That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. And we had a an institution here called Worcester Polytechnic Institute. They offer freshman courses that are built around great problems, like how to feed the world or how to create sustainable energy. And there are two linked courses that students take from different disciplines, but they all are designed to help them solve this problem. And then at the end of the semester, they put together a project or a proposal. And some of these have actually even been implemented or presented to the public. So that's the kind of thing I think we have to do. It's a lot of sort of ramp-up work. There's a lot of work in terms of how you construct something like this. But once you do that, I think it can be not substantially more work than a regular class. But you have to be willing to make that initial investment. I think that's the unfortunate part.
We'll go back to the phones now. We have Steve in Delavan. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. Enjoying the topic. I have a kind of a statistical question, kind of a mixed up. Let me go for the basics. Number one, is there a trend over time, say, is there more cheating or less cheating than similar research in 10, 20 years ago? I would tend to think that people are no more honest or less honest than they used to be, but that the quantity of cheating may be changed due to opportunities. I would think particularly writing papers invites with the access to information on the internet, cheating might be rampant in writing papers.
Yeah, so this is like an arms race, basically. The students figure out ways to plagiarize, and the internet makes a lot more available to them, but we actually have a lot more ways to catch them now. So there's a program called Turnitin.com, which most of us have access to. So it checks students' papers. You know, we can ask students to turn in their papers through this database, and it runs them against everything on the internet as well as every other paper that's been turned in through this site. So this is kind of, that's why I don't think that the numbers tend to budge very much, because while students typically find creative ways, there are creative people in the academic world who are finding ways to catch them, and it kind of just keeps going back and forth like that. So if you look at the numbers, you might see them creep up a few percentage points here and there. 10, 20 years ago, there was a survey in 1993 that replicated the 1963 one. The numbers had crept up a tiny bit, but then they seemed to have gone back down again a little bit. So no, my suggestion, as you said, you know, people are always kind of a little bit dishonest, or there's a certain percentage of people that are always going to do that. I think that's true.
And just our last minute or two, of course, people are starting classes now around the country. Give some advice to the professors out there to maybe make it a little less cheaty this year.
A little less cheaty. A couple things that I would say, first of all, is, you know, it may, for many of us, we've already started classes and we've designed our courses and put them out there. And that's, you know, if you haven't built a course around a problem, question, or challenge like that, you can build units around that so that for example, beginning a class period, even by saying, instead of saying, all right, here's what we're going to do today and here's what we did last time, begin by saying, you know, here's a fascinating question or a problem that researchers in this field have come across. Ask students what they think about it, and then, once they're interested in the question, give them the material that you want them to have at the end of that time. The other thing that we know is effective is a very simple technique that we can use to help students remember information and retain it, which is at the end of a lecture, instead of just sort of saying any questions, and which oftentimes you're just hearing crickets chirping in the room, is to say, you know, pull out a half sheet of paper and write down one thing that you learned from today's lecture. It turns out that simple little exercise can have a huge impact on students' ability to remember information much later when they're taking exams. So simple little opportunities like that for students to demonstrate their learning, even if you don't correct it or don't even collect it, some simple techniques like that can be really helpful to students.
James, thank you so much for being here today. Very interesting.
You bet.
That's James Lang, professor of English, director of the Center for Teaching Excellence at Assumption College. His new book, Cheating Lessons, Learning from Academic Dishonesty.
Coming up next, we'll talk about legislation that would keep the public away from a proposed iron mine site in northern Wisconsin. There was a public hearing today, and we'll talk to our WPR reporter who covered it. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.